Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you with us today as we take a look at some pretty cool research going on at the University of Wisconsin campus. You know, with so many renewable sources, we've got solar and wind, we've got batteries, we have phones now. Everybody's got a phone with a battery in it. I'm telling you, batteries and battery storage is becoming more and more important all the time. And there can be some concerns with those batteries, especially after they've kind of lost their useful life and need to be, say, put away safely or actually something done with them to bring them back to life. I tell you, there's a lot going on in that area. John Greenler, one of my guests today, directs education for the Wisconsin Energy Institute. And John, great to have you back.
Always a pleasure, Larry. Thank you.
Yeah, Bob Hamers for the first time with us as well. He is a professor in the Department of Chemistry. In fact, the Chambers Steenbach Professor in the Department of Chemistry at UW-Madison. He has his own startup company as well that we'll talk about a little bit too, and some of his work. And I hope you'll join in with your own questions and comments as we move along today. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. What do you think about rechargeable batteries? What do you do with your batteries when they're no longer used? Do you try to recycle them? What questions might you have about materials research? Mm-hmm. Is it materials research that you do, Bob?
That's right, Larry. Certainly do.
And when we talk about materials research, what is that really? What is material? What do you mean by materials?
Sure. Well, so in a lithium-ion battery, for example, there's three major components. One of them is called the anode. That's the negative electrode.
Yeah.
One's called the cathode, the positive electrode. And then in between, there's a liquid called the electrolyte that shuttles lithium ions back and forth. So those three components are made of different chemical compounds. The anode and the cathode are both solid. The electrolyte is liquid. And so by materials research, we mean research and developing new materials for both these, the anode and the cathode and the electrolyte, and trying to understand the properties and failure mechanisms of the materials that exist today.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting stuff there, John.
Yeah, and it really, you know, it impacts so many facets of our energy system, especially as we look towards the future in terms of clean and renewable technologies. Frequently, the limiting factor is our really having the materials to move forward with, you know, what we want to do. And it can range from, you know, very large scale. Think about the blade on a wind turbine to, mm-hmm. you know, as Bob was saying, the, you know, molecular structure on the surface of an electrode. So it's very wide-ranging, and it can be very critical in terms of success or failure with our kind of future energy systems.
And nanoscience is playing an increasingly important role, isn't it, Bob?
Right. Sure. No, that's right. So, of course, everybody wants a cell phone that'll charge faster and a laptop computer that'll charge within 10 or 15 minutes, and especially as we get toward applications like electric vehicles, where the one would like to have an electric vehicle that can charge up in 10 or 15 minutes instead of a few hours.
Right.
And a lot of these improvements actually come from taking the materials that are used in these anode and cathodes. So these would be little particles of solid materials, but by carving them up into small nanoparticles, the performance characteristics improve and you can charge them faster.
Oh, so the smaller they are, the faster they recharge.
Exactly. Right.
Okay. So what are the, are there, I'm sure that those are opportunities for sure. What about problems in that area?
Well, so there's certainly concerns. So if the particles get carved up into small enough pieces to create nanoparticles, we do a lot of work studying the properties of nanoparticles. And there are always questions about what happens if materials get released into the environment and whether the whether there are potentially adverse biological or environmental effects that we aren't aware of.
Yeah.
So there's a real trend in the industry. The existing laptops and your cell phone and computer are probably made out of a cobalt oxide. Mm-hmm. And as the as we move toward higher density and electric vehicle technologies, there's a changeover in the composition of those materials to make them less expensive and more effective, which is all great. And that's accompanied by changes in the composition of things like nickel, which have some additional potential toxicity mm-hmm. concerns associated
yeah.
with them.
And nickel has a lot of good properties in some ways from a useful standpoint, and it's frankly fairly cheap, isn't it?
Right. No, that's exactly right. That's the big driver is to make energy storage cheap. Mm-hmm. And cobalt is quite expensive, and so by being able to make it out of nickel or even iron is also being used.
So explain, you know, I don't know that we've ever done this, John, on the show, but uh-huh. We talk about nanotechnology and nanoparticles. How do we do that? How do you get nanoparticles?
Yeah, well, they can be made in two ways that are often called sort of bottom up and top down. So the bottom up way, which is the way that we actually make them in the laboratory, is through fairly simple wet chemical methods. You mix together some different compounds, you heat it up in an oven, and you will automatically get nanoparticles. Within an actual vehicle, for example, or an existing battery, even if the materials aren't necessarily nanoparticles at the start when the device is manufactured, it turns out that, you know, a typical cell phone or laptop gets charged and discharged maybe 300, 400, 500 times. Every time that happens, the materials swell and contract, and there are mechanical changes that occur that eventually sort of calve off little particles. So
again, that's pretty cool stuff, John.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, so there's, yeah, clearly the, you know, intentional, you know, use of nanoparticles, but then also we need to be aware of the fact that, yeah, they'll just be forming in the environment due to, you know, the various, you know, uses that we have, you know, for these materials, for these batteries.
And some problems. I mean, there's some research now that's coming up that could be some problems relating to a lithium, the component that could harm some key soil microorganisms.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. We've just completed a study, just a initial study looking at the biological impact of the material that's just coming of use now, a material called NMC, or nickel manganese cobalt oxide. And what we found is that if we expose certain soil bacteria, an example called a bacterium called Schuonella onidensis, it's a common soil bacterium in the environment. And what we found is that bacterium actually will be strongly affected by this NMC material. And so it raises just some questions in the long term that there currently doesn't exist any national infrastructure for recycling of battery materials. And so chances are the material gets into a landfill. If it gets into a landfill and then gets into the soil, for example, there are concerns about what those effects might be. So we really have to focus on taking sort of two approaches. One would be to say, well, can we make materials that's more environmentally benign so that if it does get into the environment, that it has less impact by the way that we change the chemical composition of the material? And on the flip side, it says, well, maybe we should think about investing in national infrastructure for recycling of these materials because they are costly.
Yeah.
And anything we can do to prevent materials from getting into the environment that shouldn't be there, the better off we are.
Well, you know, here on the University of Wisconsin-Madison campus, in the building right next door to my building, my home building, I can take my batteries over there, and they say, here, put your batteries in here, your used batteries. So I'm assuming they're recycling those batteries in some fashion.
Well, that's right. Some of the batteries are being recycled, but there's no national mandate for it right now.
Ah.
And I think a lot of people end up with their cell phone batteries. I know my daughter's dropped at least one cell phone into Lake Mendota, so
yeah.
There's at least one lithium-ion battery down there.
You know, there's one in Lake Monona, for sure. In fact, that particular phone was about 3 days old.
Oh.
And there was no insurance on that one either.
Sad story.
So there you go.
Right.
That was right out of my pocket, just like that. Oh, my goodness. We're talking today about some kind of cool research going on in the area of batteries and nanoparticles and their role in making batteries more efficient. But at the same time, there could be some problems associated with those batteries after they're used. Some components can harm soil microorganisms, as an example. I hope you'll join in. Maybe you have a question. Maybe you have a concern. Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. Jim in Green Bay couldn't stay with us, called in. Wonders if you could talk about flow batteries, including a flow battery that can last 20 years. I'm not even sure what a flow battery is, Bob.
Yep. Well, it's sort of like it sounds. It's a battery where the chemical compounds are actually flowing by one another. So the idea is in a small battery like in your cell phone or laptop, things are pretty much static, and you kind of live with what capacity you have right there. In a flow battery, you take one of those, or both potentially, one of these cathode or anode materials, and you sort of disperse it in a fluid in a way that it can actually move between a reservoir and an active material. So it's kind of like a hybrid almost between what we would call a battery and what you might call a fuel cell, in the sense that you can have a storage area outside of the air where the battery is actually doing its business.
Yeah. So now, is there some advantages to that battery, or is there?
Well, yeah, for large-scale storage, you know, when we think about batteries, we often think about things in our cell phones and maybe our laptops. But, you know, a large part of the driver for new battery materials and new batteries in general are their larger-scale applications like electric vehicles and, in particular, grid-scale energy storage, mm-hmm. right? You know, you talked earlier about the idea that people would like to be able to take advantage of wind and solar and, yep. and other intermittent energy sources. And so there's increasing interest in trying to say, well, we could really make much more efficient use of even our existing electric power generation facilities if we could actually store energy for, you know, 12 hours at a time.
Right? Sure.
The wind, for example, blows at night when we least need electricity. Power plants have to be designed to meet peak demand, not yeah. the average demand.
Yeah.
And so if we had the ability to store energy for longer periods of time, that would actually help a lot. So these larger capacity batteries like flow batteries are one of the things that's on the horizon right now for larger scale energy storage.
Pretty cool. Yeah. But they're not going to fit into your phone.
Right. Right. Unless you have a very large phone.
Oh, so. Man. All right. No, I'm yeah, back to the old days of phones. The first phones. I saw
right.
an old ad or something, you know, they were making kind of fun of it, but they let's call, you know, and the guy pulls out his phone, which is about the size of the old phone.
Right.
That he's carrying around on his hip, and I thought, oh my goodness, those actually exist, and people actually use them.
Oh yeah,
come a long way
from there. Yeah. Oh man, well, plenty to talk about as we visit about batteries with our two guests, and talking. I haven't gotten into talking about Bob's business and a little more about his research. So We'll get into that as well and certainly take your questions. Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or go ahead and post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mehler Show. I'm Larry Mehler. Breon Chesso, our producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now, having some fun talking with John Greenler, Director of Education at the Wisconsin Energy Institute and the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, and Bob Hamers, who is the Chambers Steenbach Professor in the Department of Chemistry at UW-Madison. His research, he does a lot of research in the area with batteries, and fun to talk with him about it. There are some issues associated with some of the batteries and some of the things that make up batteries, the nanoparticles, in that they can create some problems with soil microorganisms. Talking with him about that, too, and join in with your own questions at 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mehler Show. Wondering how that soil research, how that all came about.
Yeah, well, actually, so we were fortunate enough to recently be funded by the National Science Foundation to form a Center for Sustainable Nanotechnology, CSN. And so this center is actually distributed among about 12 different institutions. And what we're trying to do is take a very proactive look at asking, well, what are the nanomaterials that are going to be used in emerging technologies maybe 10 or 15 years down the road? And can we actually begin to be proactive and say, well, if these materials are going to be used in technology, can we actually identify what potential adverse environmental or health risks might exist? and try to begin to investigate what those might be at an early stage, with the idea that if we understand what the risks might be, then we can actually redesign the materials early in the design cycle and try to develop really benign materials. So that's what we're doing. So we started as a small grant about 3 years ago. And then in 2015, we got funded for a larger grant. And so this will be going on for about, well, our current grant will extend for at least 5 years. And so this will give us the opportunity to really study at basically a molecular level what's happening with these materials in the environment and try to see if we can make better materials.
Yeah, actually. And obviously, John Moore, several people involved in all this, I would guess.
Yeah, and, you know, it's interesting when you get into the world of, you know, as you were starting out in terms of soil microbiology, I mean, the diversity of microbial populations, you know, in soil is staggering, maybe would be the, you know, would be a good word for it at the very least. Just, you know, thousands and thousands of different microbes, you know, in a very small sample, extraordinary amount of diversity. And a lot of them you can't even really isolate. They're so specifically tied up in their interrelationships with other microbes. So it is a real challenging area to study and to be able to, to predict.
Right, exactly. I mean, so we started with the soil bacterium and a small number of organisms that are kind of representative. The soil bacterium is representative of what might happen in a landfill environment, for example. We're beginning to look at other kinds of organisms that might be representative of what happens in a freshwater aquatic organism, for example. And, you know, it's challenging, as you say, because there's many, many different kinds of life forms in the environment, and they don't all behave the same. So the kinds of things that might affect one organism might affect another organism. Things that might affect one organism in a positive way might actually affect a different kind of organism in a negative way. So that's why we need to understand. You know, we can't just go in and sort of an Edisonian approach and try every organism and see what happens.
Yeah.
We have to be able to develop an understanding of what happens. And that's really our goal, is to try to develop a molecular-level understanding of what these nanomaterials are doing.
Ron in La Crosse has a question for you, so let's go there. Hey, Ron, thanks for calling.
Yeah, I got a couple of questions just about batteries themselves. One question is, they used to market rechargeable alkaline batteries, and they've kind of fallen out of favor. I did buy four of them, but I didn't buy a special charger. I heard you can't recharge these rechargeable alkalines in a charger for NiCads or other types. The other question is, I've also heard that rechargeable batteries should be drawn down and used until their voltage is no longer sufficient to power the device they're in, that you should let them drawn down before recharging. Otherwise, if you prematurely recharge them, they form what they call a memory barrier. First question about the alkalines, why they don't market them anymore. And then
the other, recharging.
Sure.
Good questions, Ron.
You know, I think the answer to the rechargeable alkalines is simply that the lithium ion rechargeables are much more effective. They're less expensive to make. They certainly perform better. So I think it's more price versus performance, that you go with the best technology that's out there. Mm-hmm. And right now the lithium-ion battery is the best thing that's out there. Yeah, and then your second question regarding the memory effects. So there's all the bad things that happen in your lithium-ion battery that make it degrade with time, so you get less capacity each time you charge it, and it lasts a shorter time between charges. All of those things are controlled by undesired chemical reactions that occur on the electrode surfaces. And so for one thing, the more time your battery spends in the charged state, the more likely those things are to happen. And you're absolutely right that if you constantly charge and discharge the battery to the same amount, that there is a bit of a memory effect that is probably not really very good for the materials. So in general, it's good to charge it up, use it, bring it all the way down, and then charge it all the way up back up again.
And that varies, doesn't it, depending upon, I think the NiCad older technology were really susceptible to that problem, right?
Yeah, that's right. Today's lithium-ion batteries still have the issue a little bit, but not nearly to the extent that the older generation batteries did.
Well, you keep your, I'm guilty of this. I keep my computers on all the time, and it's plugged in all the time, so it's constantly sort of getting topped off.
That's right. That probably shortens the life. So there's multiple degradation mechanisms, multiple things that happen. One of the big ones we talked about is every time you charge and discharge the battery, you're moving lithium ions from one electrode to the other, and these electrodes actually swell and contract. Every time you charge and discharge the battery, there's a swelling and contraction, and that results in some mechanical failures, essentially. The materials literally begin to crack and crumble within the battery, and once that happens, then it's not effective anymore either. So, you know, it's a balancing act between multiple things that can go wrong. And, you know, that's the real driver when you asked me at the beginning of the show about, you know, materials research. You might ask, why do we need materials research? And the fact of the matter is the existing batteries work, but there's a lot of problems with them, right? Everybody would like something that lasts, you know, more than a year and a half and can be charged more quickly and can store more energy per unit weight. And that requires research into the new materials.
Now, and John, you were going to add something.
No, I was just going to, and, you know, economics is also a huge factor here.
Exactly.
You know, the ability to bring the price down on producing these batteries, have them last a longer time, could really be a game changer. And once again, we look at larger scale systems, we look at kind of grid or microgrid scale technologies, being able to bring that price down really does mean that we can bring on more of those clean energy, you know, sources that are intermittent. Once again, we're thinking about things like solar and wind. Mm-hmm. Being able to store some of that battery when it's in peak production to be able to use it later when there's peak demand is going to make a big difference. So.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And is it? I mean, is this something you can look at, Bob, and say, you know, we can get this done. We can do this. We can figure out ways to make these batteries last longer? And
certainly there's many things you can do. We're doing some work with coatings on the materials, for example. You know, we talked about the idea that making the particles smaller, so going from micron size particles to nanoparticles, actually avoids a lot of these problems of cracking, for example.
And your company is Silatronics, has been around for a long. Talk about that a little bit.
Sure, yeah. Silatronics is a company I co-founded with my colleague Bob West back in, we started around 2006. I think the company was incorporated in 2007. And this is really tackling the battery safety problem. So you know that current generation batteries are flammable. So I mentioned that there's three major components to the battery, the anode and the cathode, which are both solids. And then in between, there's this thing called the electrolyte. The electrolyte is just an organic liquid with some other stuff in it that basically moves lithium ions back and forth. Mm-hmm. And the problem is that the existing electrolytes are made out of a compound called an alkyl carbonate that is highly, highly flammable. And so everybody knows, for example, about the Dreamliner fire problem. Right. And, you know, a number of examples of laptop batteries going up in flames. You know, you can't bring a charged lithium-ion battery on an airplane. Right, you have to be. Mm-hmm. You can't put it into the checked luggage, and so back in 2007, we decided. My colleague Bob West had developed some new electrolytes that we thought would be good in lithium-ion batteries. So we thought would be safer, and maybe higher performance. I'm more of a materials guy. I know a lot about the anode and the cathode materials.
Yeah.
So it was like a perfect marriage. Mm-hmm. Literally happened just by walking down the hallway one day, and we started talking and started the company and over. Well, over the last 9 years, we've expanded now to having about 15 people, 16 people. About 14 of them are here in Madison, and we've got a small group of people over in Japan. So the idea is to make an electrolyte that is less flammable. And so we went through several generations of these electrolytes, and we had some materials that performed well but weren't cost-effective, and then we had some materials that were marginally good. And then about 3 years ago, we hit a home run and finally hit a new material that is a winner, both from the standpoint of giving improved performance and giving improved safety. So we've expanded that. Now we've got it going into a pilot plant in Japan. And with any luck, that should be in commercial production in early 2017.
And how will that be used then? Which batteries where will they find use?
Well, the first application will probably be cell phones, because that's relatively small batteries, and you want to test them at sort of that small scale. But it'll probably rapidly go into electric vehicles. So we're hearing some talk, for example, about, especially in China, and some of the Asian countries are moving very rapidly toward electrification. So whereas in the U.S. we benefit from having very cheap oil and gas, which has made renewables may be a little bit less cost-effective here, but a lot of the third world and developing countries are moving rapidly toward all-electric vehicles, and especially for things like public transportation. And a large driver behind that is trying to reduce the air pollution, right? We think about batteries in terms of laptops and cell phones, but in a lot of the major metropolitan areas, very large cities, air pollution from internal combustion engines is a huge problem.
Yeah.
And so the idea of being able to go to electric vehicles as much as possible is a real attractive thing to try to do.
And in California, it is a significant driver for electric car EV sales, and justifiably so, given some of the air quality issues, that they do have in places like Los Angeles, for example. So.
Right. Well, and then you think about China and some of the largest cities in China, they are horrendous, I'm told.
Right.
In terms of air pollution.
Yep. Right. And it is worth recognizing with an electric vehicle, you can be addressing the emission concern at the point of use, but there still is this much bigger systems question of, where did that electricity come from in the first place? In terms of, if you're thinking about something like greenhouse gas emissions, we need to be moving forward in terms of generating, cleaner electricity as well, which will bring down those overall carbon emissions. But especially in a situation where, you've got concerns about particulate pollution or whatever coming out of the tailpipe, it really can make a huge difference.
Right. A lot of times people think about electric vehicles about the driver being reduction of CO2 emissions, and then point out, well, you have to burn something in order to generate the electricity in the first spot. And so that's almost greenhouse gas neutral, although large power plants are more effective at generating it. But a large part of the driver is that, internal combustion engines actually spew a fair bit of pollution out into the environment. And so if you can generate that more effectively, you can put in place air pollution controls in a large power plant that are much more effective than you could ever hope to do on an individual automobile.
Right.
Right. And so from that standpoint, there's a big driver to move toward electric vehicles for reduction of air pollution.
Just take it to a sort of my own level. I gave up on a lawnmower, gas-powered lawnmower, internal combustion one. Somebody told me on the show that you do your lawn, and that's about the equivalent of driving your car to Chicago.
Yep, it's essentially every minute you've got your lawnmower on, it's the same thing. It's like barreling down the highway in your car. People have very little understanding. Yeah, lawnmowers are very high pollution pieces of equipment.
So what do? I go and buy an electric one that I plug in. All right, so it's not a battery that. It's one that I plug into my house electricity.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
I don't have, it's not a battery that I charge the battery and then that drives the.
Mm-hmm.
So now I'm wondering, is that any more?
it probably is, yeah. is a very good step forward. Because, one of the problems with these small engines is that because they're so cheap, their efficiency is very, very low, and there's no catalytic converter, so they put so much more pollution out per unit of fuel used and time used or whatever. So at least with your car, you've got something that is much more sophisticated, much more efficient, much cleaner, and then going to electricity is even one step better yet.
Mike in Madison has a question. Mike, hi, thanks for calling.
Good morning.
Morning.
I read a lot about new battery technologies, and I know there's a lot of stuff cutting edge with graphene, carbon nanotubes, and other 2D materials. I wanted to hear your thoughts on that, and what do you think the progress will be with that?
Mm. Yeah, sure. Okay. Well, so certainly, nanotubes are basically little graphite sheets that are wrapped up into a tube, and then graphene is like a single sheet of graphite. Graphite's a common mineral. It's a layered compound. You slice off a single sheet and you've got graphene. So graphene in particular is an amazing compound because it's got incredibly high electrical conductivity and very high surface area. So it's already being used in some sense to improve the conductivity of the materials. So in these anode and cathodes in the lithium-ion batteries, The materials themselves are not very conductive, so they're always mixed in with some form of carbon, sometimes something called carbon black. But nanotubes and graphene are being used there. There's another technology also that's kind of coming on board that's called an electrochemical double-layer capacitor, or EDLC. And this is sort of like a battery in the sense that it stores energy, but it stores it over much shorter periods of time. And so often people are talking about using EDLCs in conjunction with a lithium-ion battery. And in that particular application, graphene is probably having really tremendous impact because it can, it essentially operates by ions sticking to the surface of the graphene sheets. And so this material has such incredible surface area and incredible conductivity that it's really an ideal material for use in those kinds of applications. So
really,
yeah, yet another example of new materials being used in HELP technology.
Very cool. Thanks, Mike. Appreciate the call very much. We had Gene and Ashlyn called in, something you were touching on a little bit earlier, I think, but in some circumstances, batteries can explode, can be dangerous and explode. And, you know, some of the batteries are used in everything from e-cigarettes to hearing aids. You know, you certainly wouldn't want one exploding in your hearing aid. Can you talk a little bit more about the dangers associated with that?
Sure. Yeah. So there's two reasons why that can occur. So in the conventional laptop, like you've got today, your cell phone, if you overcharge that material, so that's the danger of leaving a charge in all the time, is the cobalt oxide can actually release oxygen, and it can actually pressurize the insides of the battery a little bit. The other thing that happens is the electrolyte, over time, breaks down, it also releases carbon dioxide and CO2. And so what that does is it makes the batteries pressurize internally, and they begin to swell up. And sometimes you'll see an older laptop might have its bottom bulging a little bit from the CO2 that's pressurized that battery. And the real hazard there, of course, is if that cell phone develops a little bit of a leak and you start getting a fine mist of this electrolyte, which is highly flammable, coming out, and you have a source of a spark, then pretty soon you can have a pretty major fire pretty fast.
Oh.
So that's actually one of the reasons I mentioned that my company, Silotronics, has made a safer electrolyte that's now being commercialized. One of the advantages of that new electrolyte is that it shuts down this gassing mechanism that's caused by the carbon dioxide. So that means the batteries can be operated for longer periods of time, higher voltage, higher temperatures, and still have a strong safety margin.
And these, and I forget the name of these sort of almost skate-like things that have been blowing up recently, are catching fire. Kids use them and, you know.
Oh, hoverboards?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
I was trying to I could not remember the name of those. Having never gotten on one and never planning to ever get on one, I've never really kept that name. But there's a battery there.
I guess so. Yeah, it's something I don't know that much about.
All right. So I wondered about the batteries inside those things because they're apparently...
My guess is they're packed in there pretty densely because, I mean, clearly if you're moving a whole, you know, the weight of a human body around, you're going to need a lot of power.
Well, all the new batteries are what are called pouch cells or prismatic cells. So instead of being like the old batteries used to be, it would be called a jelly roll. It would be round, like a round cylinder.
Yeah.
And now everything's going to these flat packs. And, you know, people are interested in being able to put them in various parts of cars, right? So instead of having a battery all in one spot, you could imagine having a battery that's embedded into the side panels of your car and distributed all throughout the car. So that you don't have to take up your entire trunk space with a big lithium-ion battery pack.
Wow. So that's what people are working toward right now.
Right. Conformable batteries, things that can be molded into different shapes and stored in various places.
Well, batteries is the correct word, but we've talked about, and John, you brought a young woman over who's done some research on collecting power right in your clothing.
Exactly. Yeah, this would be the perfect complement to that, right?
Right.
It would be
right.
Perfect complement as I'm thinking about it. Oh, man. Steve in Boulder Junction, I want to bring this up. Steve in Boulder Junction called. He says he's heard about cell phones getting fuel cells in place of batteries.
Yeah, well, sure, there's been a lot of talk about fuel cells. There's two general types of fuel cells. One is called a hydrogen fuel cell that has a hydrogen stored internally and then uses oxygen from the air to make water. And when President Bush was in the White House, there was a big push toward the hydrogen economy.
Yeah.
And it didn't go all that far. I think there were some real concerns about storing compressed hydrogen.
Moving it around is really a problem.
Yep. And that, but there's also a generation that are called direct methanol fuel cells, and there's been talk about ethanol-based fuel cells. And so basically a fuel cell oxidizes something or sort of burns it without a flame, essentially. So it takes a material like methanol or ethanol and converts it into CO2 and derives energy from it. And there's been a huge amount of research on this, and so far it's still somewhat limited. They suffer from poisoning effects, and they seem to not last as long as what's needed. But, you know, it's still a very interesting area of technology, and if we could actually get fuel cells to work, that would be, I think, a tremendous alternative to batteries. And I think there's, you know, in the end, the energy storage arena, there's lots of different devices and systems, and so they certainly have their place.
How'd you get interested in this?
Oh, I was always interested in energy research going back to the oil crisis of the Jimmy Carter eras in the 1970s, and remember waiting in gas lines for many hours. But no, but I've always been intrigued by, you know, being good stewards of our planet. And to me, energy and clean water are two of the biggest problems facing the planet. And as scientists, we have a social responsibility to try to do what's good for the planet and good for society. And so this struck me as being someplace where chemists like me can actually make a pretty positive contribution to the quality of life.
It's a very, very cool.
Isn't that great?
Isn't that, oh, man.
Lots to look forward to in this area, that's for sure.
I'm really looking for, I'm excited, frankly, about the research that you're doing and others are doing in this area. And
yeah.
It really bodes well. You'd like to know, I wish I knew right today, what it's going to be like 20, even 10 years from now.
Oh, right. I mean, tremendous advances. It's an incredible field for anybody who's interested in science. Energy research is a really, really interesting area, and in part because there's so many things that can be done, and many advances.
Really cool stuff. And so a degree in chemistry and or chemical engineering?
Yeah, chemistry, chemical engineering, material science.
Yeah, those
they're all very great areas.
Sure. Well, a real pleasure, Bob, to talk with you. And John, as always, great to have you with us, too.
Always learning. It's great, Larry.
Oh, it's a lot of fun to learn about the exciting work that's going on in so many areas, especially this area, something that's kind of, I'm kind of near and dear to my interests. John Greenler and Bob Hamers, our guests today. John directs education for the Wisconsin Energy Institute at UW and the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center. Bob Hamers is a professor of chemistry. He's in the Department of Chemistry at UW-Madison, where he is the Chambers Steenbach Professor. He's doing some pretty cool stuff. And we'll talk with him again, I'm pretty sure about that, because my guess is there are going to be a lot more to talk about as we move along today. And a couple of other guys I was like talking about or with are the weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin. And I'm looking out my window out of my studio, and I can see Steve Ackerman out there. I bet John Martin isn't far behind. We'll talk weather and climate with them next on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.